Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of both the Evangelical Apologetic Society and the New South Wales Humanist Association, I'm pleased to welcome you to tonight's debate. The topic of the debate is humanism or Christianity, that the Christian God exists and is relevant today.
Amen.
I'll just briefly introduce the two speakers and then outline the topic of the debate. We're privileged tonight to have two very distinguished speakers, and the first speaker will be Mr. Mark Plummer. Mr. Plummer is a former president of the national president of the Australian Humanists. He's a lawyer, a journalist. He's participated in two lecture tours to the United States, the first of which was sponsored by the American Atheists. Dr. John Montgomery is currently Dean of Simon Greenleaf School of Law in Orange County, California, in the United States. He was formerly a director of studies at the International Institute of Human Rights, Strasbourg, France. A theologian, philosopher, historian, barrister and attorney, and a human rights specialist and writer. The program of the debate will be that Mr. Plummer will first speak for 30 minutes, and then Dr. Montgomery will speak for 30 minutes. Then there'll be a period of 20 minutes interchange in which first Mr. Plummer and then Dr. Montgomery will have the opportunity of about 2.5 minutes to make comments against the in relation to what's been said already, and perhaps to cover points that were raised by the other speaker. That will be 2.5 minutes each for about 20 minutes. It'll just be a casual brief interchange. Following that exchange, there'll be a period of a break of 20 minutes, which will be an opportunity to have some refreshments and to think about your questions for the forum that's to follow. Then I'll be receiving questions from the floor. There'll be a couple of rules about the questions, and they'll be very brief, and but they'll be quite firmly enforced. The rules are that the questions will be addressed alternately to the speakers. I don't mind which goes first, but the questions will not be Dorothy Dick's questions, setting up a speaker to put words into your own mouth, just to go further onto a point you want to make. There should be a question challenging the speaker who you're asking to address that question to. So it's not an opportunity just to extend the forum, it's an opportunity to challenge speakers on things they've said. It can just be understood as that. And I would ask people to cooperate and keep my task in this to a minimum. Following that 30 minutes of questions, let's get that right. Yes, following that 30 minutes of questions, each of the speakers, Dr. Montgomery first and finally Mr. Plummer, will be speaking for 10 minutes to sum up the issues that have been raised in the debate. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Mr. Plummer to debate the topic humanism or Christianity, that the Christian God exists and is relevant today. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. I'm pleased to be here, and I'm pleased that so many of you have given up one of the lovely evenings of the Sydney weather you have up here to come along tonight. Coming from Melbourne, we've had some pretty lousy weather, and it's always a pleasure to come up to Sydney, particularly when the New South Wales Humanist Society invites me up and looks after you while I'm up here. I'm glad that Dr. Montgomery is debating tonight. I'm always pleased to find Christians who are prepared to openly debate their beliefs. I've often thrown out challenges myself and to have the other side backing away. Tonight I debate as a representative of the New South Wales Humanist Society. Although the New South Wales Humanist Society asked me to speak, many of them would probably disagree with my own personal atheism. It's a policy of the humanist movement that there's no party line, no sacred text, that divergent views are respected and encouraged. My views are that gods and goddesses, including the Christian God, do not exist, and that because gods and goddesses do not exist, the Christian God is therefore irrelevant. However, I believe the concept of a Christian God is relevant, highly relevant, and I'll expand on that later. Now, looking at the reasons as to why I don't believe that gods and goddesses in general exist, there are a number of reasons. Perhaps you could take the sociological line. You could look at Emile Durkheim. And this holds that the gods that men and women worship are imaginary beings unconsciously fabricated by society as instruments whereby it exercises control over the thought and behaviour of the individual. This theory claims that when men have religious feelings of standing before a higher power which transcends their personal lives and impresses its will upon them as a moral imperative, they are indeed in the presence of a greater environing reality. This reality is not, however, a supernatural being. I consider it's just a natural fact of society as society has evolved. The encompassing human group exercises the attributes of the deity in relation to its members and gives rise in their minds to the concept of a god, which in effect is thus becoming a symbol of a particular society. Next point is the concept of why do we need to even look for the gods to explain society and to explain the universe. If we look at Occam's razor, the concept that gods merely complicate the understanding of things, that it'd be quite possible to explain the universe without them, and presupposing them merely creates fresh problems and doesn't solve any particular problems. We could take a Freudian view, but Freud has been a bit discredited of late, and I myself aren't a Freudian. But to my mind, one of the greatest aspects is the challenge of modern science. Now, the expansion of modern science since the Reformation, since the Renaissance, since the Dark Ages, has a profound influence on religious belief. And it's been at its maximum in the Judeo-Christian tradition with which perhaps we're most concerned tonight. There's been vast discoveries of knowledge in fields such as astronomy, geology, zoology, chemistry, and physics. And contradicting assertions in the same fields, derived from the Bible rather than direct observation and experiment, have increasingly been discarded. We no longer believe that the sun goes around the earth. In each of the great battles between science and churchmen, the validity of the scientific method has been vindicated by its practical usefulness. Over and over again, adjustments have been made in the aspects of religious belief which conflicted with the scientists' discoveries. As a result of this long debate, it's become apparent that biblical writers, recording their experiences of God's activities in human society, inevitably closed their testimony with their own contemporary pre-scientific understanding of the world. We no longer need to believe the world was created 6,000 years ago, that man and the other animal species came into being in their present forms. We no longer believe that the sun rotates around the earth, despite the fact that at one of the recent creationist conferences in America, some creationists were arguing those particular points. So, I believe that modern science has been able to rebut so much of what's in the Bible that they've established the autonomy of the natural order, that the universe and the world can exist without the need for gods, that the universe can be explained without God. This does leave one minor aspect, and that is that some people believe that God might have created the universe and has then proceeded from there. This is the old deist viewpoint. But I no longer need to believe the deist viewpoint. Modern science has shown us and given us explanations as to how the world evolved. To me, one of the most powerful positive objections to belief in God is the fact of evil. To me, it's the appalling depth and the extent of human suffering more than anything else that makes the idea of a loving creator so implausible and disposes me to naturalistic theories. If God is perfectly loving, he must wish to abolish evil. And if he is all-powerful, he must be able to abolish evil. But evil exists, and therefore God cannot be both all-powerful and perfectly loving. If we define God as being all-knowing, all-powerful, and infinite, and all-good, then how can we have the suffering in the universe? Either the God can prevent it, but he won't, or he would but cannot. If he can prevent it, but he won't, then he can't be all-loving. If he would, but he can't, then he can't be all-powerful and infinite. But then, of course, you can argue the free will argument. Now, animals suffer, but they haven't been given free will. This immediately negates this naturalistic law argument. And if God had intended to give human beings free will, he's supposed to be all-knowing. Thus, as all-knowing, he will know the consequences in advance. And this supposes he is not all good. Either he created or is responsible for the evil in the world, or he did not, in which case evil exists independently of him, and goodness can also exist independent of him. The all-powerful God doesn't have to be logical. God could have created a happy world with free will. There is a contradiction in saying that God has made us so that we shall of necessity act in a certain way, and that we are genuinely independent persons in relation to him. If all our thoughts and actions are divinely predestined, however free and morally responsible we may seem to be to ourselves, we cannot be free and morally responsible in the sight of God, but must instead be his helpless puppies. Such freedom I can compare to that of a patient acting out of a series of post-hypnotic suggestions. He appears even himself to be free, but what he does has been predetermined by another will, that of the hypnotist. Following on the aspect of whether or not there are gods or goddesses, and you must remember that the majority of the world doesn't believe in the Christian God, here comes the question, if there is a God, how can we be sure that it is a Christian God, that is not a Hindu God or a Muslim God? The world was not created by a Hindu God or a Muslim God. It's interesting that just this week a group of Islamic scholars have arrived in Australia and are going around proving that the Quran and modern science shows that Allah made the world. And these gentlemen have spent years of their lives researching the Quran, looking for applications in modern society and modern scientific knowledge to prove the Quran. Who is to say that they're not just as right as the Christian who has spent his entire life researching and looking for information to support a Christian God? Christians, I find, are convinced that Christianity is the one true faith and that everyone else is in serious, tragic error. And yet even among themselves, Christians are forever factionalizing and fracturing. We have the Protestants against the Catholics against the Baptists, the Jehovah's Witnesses against the Mormon, and so on. And often, when I go into religious bookshops to pick up my latest copy of New Life, see what they've written about me, I notice that most of the books are attacking other brands of Christian faiths rather than other religions. There's always an interesting section there attacking the Hindu faith or whatever, but it's quite small in most of these bookshops I go to. Now, there's the paradox. Christians accuse me of not knowing what I'm talking about, of having a closed mind as to the unassailable truth of the Bible, while Christians themselves dismiss religions of equal authority and more often than not older than their own. In short, Christians look down their noses, patronise and poo-poo other people's gods. And when it comes to the belief systems of the rest of the earth, Christians are the sceptics, agnostics and atheists. In short, Christian religion, the Christian's attitude to other religions is the same as mine to all religions. Yet Christians don't seem to be aware of this contradiction. Christians talk about their faith often as a country that they've discovered as a result of a bold and brave exploration. The fact is that it's a country that discovered them. Far from coming to their faith at the end of a long journey, they got it as a result of standing still, of being born. For 99% of all believers of all faiths, religion's a matter of geography. If you're born in Sydney to a Sydney family, a Sydney Christian family, you'll be raised as a Christian. If you're born in a particular part of India to a Hindu family, you'll be raised as a Hindu. Perhaps if you're born in a slightly separate area of India, you might be a Sikh. A train journey, another family, and you could be a Muslim. You don't embrace a religion, religions embrace you. Your culture imposes it on you from birth. You're born without a belief, the culture then brings you up in a particular belief of the culture. Your beliefs come with the territory, much like whichever electorate you happen to live in. Now, once having been born into a particular faith, people tend to build on it, on what I'd like to describe as the ratchet effect. Now, some of us here tonight, I'm sure, are old enough to remember the old watches where you used to have to wind up by hand with a curled knob on one side, that you had hands instead of little coloured rectangular numbers. And we used to wind these watches by turning the knob backwards and forward between our fingers. When you wound it one way, it caused the spring to tighten. But when you wound it the other way, it didn't cause the spring to loosen. And that work inside this watch is a miracle of a decidedly unreligious nature called a ratchet. Rotation forward increases the tightness on the spring, but rotation backwards doesn't. Now, I'd like to compare the human brain to a ratchet, and one that swings into place whenever people are confronted with something they believe in. As they grow old and they're brought up through Sunday school and church, whatever they come across that adds to their faith, the faith of their parents, or their society, their culture, it advances the ratchet a little, tightens the spring a bit. When they come across something, such as an atheist as myself, that doesn't fit in, they'll listen to it, but it doesn't loosen the main spring. If they come across something that doesn't reinforce the belief, something that even contradicts it, the wheel might rotate in the opposite direction, but the spring doesn't loosen, until perhaps to some people their spring does snap. I now propose to move on to the question of morality and God. And before examining the question of morality without God, which is advertised as one of the aspects we're looking at, I really think we have to look at how moral was God, allegedly the Father of Christ. Now, this all-powerful God designed and created all, designed sharks, snakes, tigers, vermin, crocodiles, cholera germs, a lot. He all-purposely made them, and he pronounced their creation in Genesis 1:31, very good. God then condemned all people for the offence of one man, Adam, and these quotes all come from the King James Version of the Bible. I noticed that the Islamic scholar said this week that the Quran hadn't been altered in the centuries, but the Bible tends to be filled around with every few hundred years. But in Romans 5:12, we read that by one man sin entered the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men for all that have sinned. So Christianity teaches us that death was unknown till Adam munched the apple, so that all animals were first made to suffer death through the fall of man. Thus, divine vengeance for apple eating means that men and women are condemned to eternal torments hereafter, a terrible punishment of which Adam was never warned. Just as I wasn't warned, this lectern had a very low surface. And Adam and Eve had no knowledge of the distinction between good and evil, or right or wrong, till after the petty crime which entailed such a fearful and universal penalty. I personally consider to pluck the fruit of the tree of knowledge is a virtuous act rather than a punishable one. And I find a lot of religious people are very nervous about even reading what the atheist viewpoint might be. So I'm very pleased you've come tonight to listen to it. We now move on to the alleged flood. And we find that all created beings, except those in the ark, animals, unborn babies, pregnant women, innocent children were drowned because God had made one species, man, imperfect. Genesis 7. I often wonder when I hear Christians on the radio and the television talking about looking for the ark, why they don't look for the water instead, because there's an awful lot of it to get the ark up the top of Mount Ararat, and just where it's gone is one of the great mysteries of the world. God's attitude to children can also be seen in that he commanded human sacrifice, Jeremiah 7, makes it obvious that the Jews bear their sons and daughters, even comparatively late. God commanded Abraham to sacrifice his only son, Isaac. God's attitude to those who are not the chosen ones can be seen when God acted as the midnight assassin on the largest scale, murdering the innocent firstborn of every Egyptian family, Exodus 12. Moving on in Exodus, we find that God then drowned many Egyptians, Exodus 14. We find that God crushed his opposition by fire, earthquake, and pestilence, Numbers 16. On the question of slavery, we can see that God sanctioned slavery in Leviticus 20. He ordered slave capturing exhibitions in Deuteronomy 20, and that he said that a slave may be slowly beaten to death, Exodus 21. We can examine God's attitude to women, and it's an attitude that has helped oppressed women over the centuries. According to God, women may be captured, violated, and if not sexy enough, may be turned out of doors, helpless, friendless, in a foreign land. I'd like to read this particular passage to make God's message and to give you an idea of his morality crystal clear. It comes from Deuteronomy 21:10. When thou goest forth to war against thine enemies, and the Lord thy God hath delivered them into your hands, and thou hast taken them captive, and seest among the captives a beautiful woman, and hast a desire unto her, thou shalt go into her, and be her husband, and she shall be thy wife. And if it shall be that if thou have no delight in her, then thou shalt let her go whither she will. God's word also states that a man may sell his daughters, Exodus 21. Also, part of his attitude to women, and one that is only now really being properly researched and brought out, is the whole witchcraft. The Bible clearly states that witches are to be killed. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, Exodus 22. A man also, or a woman that hath a familiar spirit, or that is a wizard, shall surely be put to death. They shall stone them with stones, their blood shall be upon them, Leviticus 20. Hundreds of thousands of innocent women were put to death through the Bible teaching concerning the purely imaginary crime of witchcraft. God didn't just order the death of women. He killed people wanting a change of diet, Numbers 11, burnt priests alive for using the wrong sort of fire, Leviticus 10. We can also look at other laws that God set out in the Bible. God's revealed word is clearly set out when the death penalty should be used. Death for consulting wizards, Leviticus 20. Death for adultery or heresy, Deuteronomy 13. A father is to slay his own daughter or wife or son or friend for a difference of religion. Again, the whole passage. If thy brother, the son of thy mother, or thy son or thy daughter, or the wife of thy bosom, or thy friend, which is as thy own soul, entice thee secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, thou shalt not consent unto him, nor hearken unto him, neither shall thou I pity him, neither shall thou spare him, neither shall thou conceal him, but thou shalt surely kill him. Thy hand shall be the first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. And thou shalt stone him with stones, that he shall die. Deuteronomy 13. When we consider a theocratic state is like, we don't have to look further than Iran, where the Ayatollah's henchmen are determined to impose what's in the Quran. And I'd hate to see fundamentalist Christians really try and impose the letter of the law in the Bible. It's also death to Sabbath breakers. Whosoever doeth any work on the Sabbath, he shall surely be put to death, Exodus 31. It's death for kindling a fire on the seventh day. Whoever soweth to a work therein shall be put to death. Ye shall kindle no fire throughout your habitation upon the Sabbath day, Exodus 35. Everyone who defileth shall be put to death. It's even death for picking up sticks on the Sabbath. So Christians often forget they're continually breaking God's law by not stoning to death those who work or kindle a fire on the Sabbath. A lot of other rules in there. We have death for not eating, for eating fat, death for eating blood, death for imitating holy ointment, death for making perfume, death for sacrifice without the priest's aid, most of these are from Leviticus, death for killing cattle without bringing an offering to the priest, death for purely ceremonial offences, death for touching a holy thing, and death for approaching the holy candlestick. In Deuteronomy, we read death for unchastity or for natural or accidental imperfection of a woman. But if this thing be true and the tokens of virginity be not found on the damsel, then they shall bring out the damsel to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her with stones, that she shall die, because she has wrought folly in Israel. It's Deuteronomy 22:20. Now God assigns no punishment for similar unchastity on the part of men. The man who brought a false charge of this kind against his bride was only fined a penalty of silver. Also in Numbers and Exodus we can find death for entering the holy place, death for entering the holy place without linen breeches, Exodus 28:42, death for not being purified, death for working on the Day of Atonement, death to stray near the tabernacle. When the tabernacle is to be pitched, the lip shall set it up, and the stranger that it cometh nigh shall be put to death, Numbers 1:51. So if this is God, the alleged father of Jesus exists, there's no way I could support his morality, his laws. I put out my challenge tonight, first of these challenges, to Dr. Montgomery, as to whether or not he supports capital punishment. If so, for which of the above crimes? Most of those quotes are from the Old Testament. In fact, in the New Testament, you'll find passages indicating that the laws set out in the Old Testament are to be followed, that not by one small amount shall they be varied. The New Testament also gives examples of Jesus' morality. Jesus recommended castration in Matthew 19. Jesus recommended celibacy in Matthew 19. Jesus recommended hatred of parents and wife and family in Luke 14, 26. And if anyone doubts these, we've got the Bibles here tonight, and I can give people even a full set of all this. And desertion of wife and children, Luke 14. And with examples like these, I think your own sense of morality will show you that you couldn't support that. Now, given the choice between God's laws, as revealed in the Bible, and laws made by men and women, the Bible doesn't think much of women making laws, elected from and responsible to their electorate, responsible to their fellow citizens, I would always choose the latter. Now, in supporting a call to follow God's laws, Christians advance a theory that without Christianity, society would degenerate. Another version of that is that our society is currently degenerating because of a declining belief and observances in Christianity. Now, if you accept a relationship between the belief in the Christian God and deviant and society's behaviour, or that between a lack of belief in a Christian God and deviant behaviour, then there's a lot of evidence available. Now, one I want to look at is a quick comparison of America and Australia. These two Western societies are very similar. Both have a common language, both are ex-British colonies, have a legacy of rugged individualism, have attained the outback, influx of migrants, they've developed an ethnic diversity. Today, both are very heavily urbanised, and America influences us very strongly. One American reporter recently wrote in the Adelaide Advertiser, Stephen Ford, that Australians pursue the ideals of the American middle-class dream even more relentlessly than Americans do. So the evidence of the strength of the US culture and business influence is to be found everywhere in Australia. However, there's a major difference between religious belief and observances. Now, I quote from the Value Study of 1983, which found that 95% of Americans believe in God, compared to 79% of Australians. 66% of Americans believe in the devil, compared to 36% of Australians. 57% of Americans believe they should keep the Sabbath day holy, but only 28% of Australians do. Americans have a much higher participation rate in weddings, funerals, baptisms. Americans attend church twice as often as Australians. Yet we find that crime rates in America are much higher than Australia. American rates of violent crime, such as homicide, robbery, rape and assault, are 3 to 4 times higher than that in Australia. If we go to the other end of the scale, and we turn to a country with one of the lowest rates of Christian believers, Japan, we find only 39% believe in God, 11% in the devil. We find a lower crime rate than in Australia. We can, of course, move from statistics to examples. We can look at the actions of Christian leaders such as Jim Jones. We can look at other examples that have come through. Well, you might laugh, but I feel that in the way Jim Jones preached fundamentalism to his followers, he was probably closer to what's laid out in the Old Testament than what many mainstream religions push forward today. I find that God's laws are moral and irrelevant as a guide to modern society. But I don't find the concept of a Christian God irrelevant. This is because a number of people who believe in it, or claim to believe in the Christian God, manipulate others' belief in a Christian God to persuade them to support political campaigns which impinge upon the activities of non-believers such as myself. We have the classic example of the Moral Majority in our own homegrown festival of life, modelled on the Moral Majority. Many of you probably support some of the political stances of the Moral Majority or the Festival of Life. Your judgment, I might say, on any of these current stances would be coloured by that support. Perhaps I can put it in a different perspective. By looking at the relationship between Christians and law in the past, Christians, to me, never seem to have recovered from the loss of power of the churches and the ecclesiastical courts to parliamentary democracy. Law based on the interpretation of religious text by self-appointed experts is given away to law making by representatives elected by the people. In the last century, law reformers of Western society have had to overcome church opposition to such reforms as the use of anaesthesia in childbirth, because Genesis 3:16 says that childbirth should give birth in pain, Sunday trading, Sunday entertainment, Sunday newspapers, the opening of libraries and museums on Sundays, the use of affirmations, creations, birth control, divorce, non-religious weddings, the rights of non-believers to sit in parliament, the right of women to vote and sit in parliament, sex education, in vitro fertilisation and pensions for unmarried mothers. The opposition to some of the above reforms still continues in Australia. With hindsight, we can see the absurdity of the church's attitude to some of those particular areas, and perhaps later on you'll understand my own approaches to why I'm very against churches influencing people in the political arena. There's a second area I want to cover, and that is one of financial exploitation. Exploitation by church leaders of their followers. Now, the Bible is quite clear on this point. It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God, Matthew 19. I've had a special interest in US evangelists visiting Australia or having their TV shows broadcast in Australia, and I have written some very lengthy articles, which have been published here and overseas, on looking at US evangelists. Just a couple of weeks ago, Herbert W. Armstrong died. He couldn't take his money with him. In 1983, it was estimated an income of $132 million. Now, the revenue of some of the others, Falwell, $57 million, Jimmy Backer, $50 million, Oral Roberts, $48 million, Swaggart, $45 million, Robert Shulock, $23 million, and Rex Humber, $22 million. Now, they've been most reluctant to give any breakdown of their Australian operations. However, I was able to get hold of Robert Shuler's balance sheets, the only one that were lodged in corporate affairs, and found that he had been raising money from Australia and sending it across to America, but that he had told the Broadcasting Tribunal in his submission that all funds raised were used for the direct cost of his television ministry in Australia. Armstrong had a $500,000 mansion in Pasadena. When the California State Attorney General looked at his affairs, he found that he spent extravagantly. Jerry Falwell lives in a $500,000 house. Jimmy Bakker has a house worth $375,000, and so on. I wrote an 8,000-word article just outlining all of this. Well, I'm sorry you're unaware of some of the scientific advances of late, but let's look at a very interesting religious phenomena, a very religious phenomena, the moving statues phenomena of Ballyspittle. Now, none of you have been aware of what's been going on in Ireland, that thousands of people have gone out to see statues of the Virgin Mary that allegedly move, cry, this sort of thing. Now, there are tens of thousands of Irish people who will swear black and blue, give eyewitness testimony, that those statues move regularly. And the hot dog vendors and ice cream men love it when they all queue up to go and see it. Now, we now understand modern perception. We can put modern instruments on, like surveyor's instruments, to check whether there's any movement in those statues. We understand how the movement of the body can change people's perception of something. In other words, we now have a whole field of human science that can assist us in re-examining miracles, in inverted commas. We talk about, for example, the resurrection of the Lord rising. In this very city, there are people who claim they can levitate. And for 5 years, I've been looking at this whole question of levitation and rising.
I wish you'd brought some of them tonight. It would have been very entertaining along with the,
right,
with the debate.
We have a professor of physics in Sydney. We have a professor of philosophy at the University of New England who proclaim that people can levitate here in Sydney. And for 5 years, I've been saying, I've written 4 articles on it, just let me in there one day with the instruments. Just let me in there one day with the sort of people who know how to make observations, and we'll see whether they levitate or not.
Well, now that's a very good point. The reason why you are highly suspicious of that sort of thing, and the reason why you don't think that the statues are exuding oil here in Australia, is because there are hostile people who go and see this sort of thing, and they don't see the same thing. The presence of hostile witnesses is the thing that makes the difference. Well, now, excuse me, I'm in full tilt here. And in the case of the crucifixion and a purported resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, you had interest groups that had the means, the motive, and the opportunity to refute this. For example, the Sanhedrin, the Jewish religious leaders, they had contact with the events. They had every reason to refute this because it was such a threat to their religious position, and they had every opportunity because the early Christians were silly enough to go right into the synagogues to proclaim this kind of thing. Do you seriously think that if there had been the kind of evidence equivalent to what you're talking about available, it wouldn't have been used?
I don't think the Romans and others were all that interested at that time.
Well, the Romans weren't. We weren't talking about the Romans. They were out collecting taxes. All right?
Like the evangelists.
You have an economic hang-up.
Seriously. Dr. Montgomery, when I heard you were to speak, the first thing I did was, and I'll say this quite honestly, was to ring America and say, what do you know about Dr. Montgomery? And people said, he's straight. Seriously, no one said, I'll send you over the file of the really dirty stuff. But they generally accepted that he was a genuine, straight, that there was no financial problem. He's back, and I fully accept that. Now, the reason I'm into economics is this. We can't prove necessarily what's going on in a person's mind. Only we can judge by their actions. And we can judge very simply in the area of balance sheets that when Robert Shuler says that all funds raised are used in Australia for his ministry, and when I can go down to the corporate affairs office, and he said that first statement in a submission to the Australian Broadcasting Tribunal in 1983, and I can go to corporate affairs and find the actual records, the actual amounts raised, and when I can sit in Dr. Shuler's cathedral and see the Australian wing and hear the guide tell me that was paid for by Australians, I know I've got somewhere someone isn't telling the truth. And then when I leave the guided tour of Dr. Robert Shuler's Crystal Cathedral, and I go around the back part of the offices, and I get my photograph taken next to those beautiful limousines. Well,
Mr. Plummer, if we could show that Dr. Schuller was a polygamist, would that disprove Christianity and establish humanism?
No, but it would make me doubt him as... when you check his veracity, it makes me doubt Dr. Schuller's message. Now, as regards polygamists, I went to your lovely city of Salt Lake City.
Let's clarify this. When you hear this about Dr. Schuller, it makes you question his message. Logically, Mr. Plummer, all it does is to make you question that he should be proclaiming that message. It says absolutely nothing logically about whether the message itself is good, bad, or indifferent. And what you're engaged in... What you're engaged in is simple ad hominem.
You're constantly
speaking to the man. You are not doing this ad argumentum. The issue is not Dr. Schuller. The issue is not Herbert Armstrong. The issue is not financial accountability. The issue is whether or not Jesus Christ, in fact, rose again from the dead and established the truth of his religion, and whether you can derive any moral values from the human situation in flux. And you've got to face those issues, and if you don't do it, you're being intellectually dishonest.
I'm surprised that you, as a lawyer, don't look at the credibility of a witness, that if you have a person who gets up on a charge of shoplifting, and he's got 99 previous convictions for shoplifting, and he gets up and he says he's an honest man, he's never shoplifted in his life, then clearly his credibility can be knocked down and is knocked down under our legal system if he tries to get up there and say that he hasn't got any previous convictions. Now, if someone gets up there and tells me X, Y, and Z, and I find out that X, Y, and Z are wrong, provably wrong. You see, because this financial accountability is an area I can get right into, that it's very hard to disagree with figures.
Yes, Mr. Plummer, suppose Einstein had been caught shoplifting. Would that mean that E equals MC squared was untrue? Do you see the logic of this?
If Einstein was putting up propositions that couldn't be scientifically proven and laid his credibility on the line on the basis of his honesty, then I'd be a bit suspicious. Now, Einstein's E equals MC squared is scientifically provable. Much of what you say isn't.
That's what we're here to find out. See, that isn't the case a priori. You can't come in and simply say, there isn't adequate evidence for Christianity. It all depends upon some evangelist getting up and trying to convince us of his own personal integrity. The way to deal with this, Mr. Plummer, is to check out, number one, the New Testament documents, to find out if these documents are historically reliable. Number two, to see what the testimony has to say in those documents, the testimony purporting to be by eyewitnesses of those events. And then to see whether the major event of those records, the alleged resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, can be adequately explained away. Now, if you can deal with that kind of thing, then you've got somewhere. But you're never going to get anywhere simply by making allegations.
Yeah, but there are things that are researchable and things that are not.
What, you mean history can't be researched?
No, history can be researched.
Ah,
and there's a lot of,
this is history.
There are a lot of historical researchers who don't accept the sort of research you do because they see you have a value judgment in it. Let's look at the Schuller and
Trout. You don't have a value
example.
Judgment? Do you think anybody can go into the study of history with no value judgment? Everybody has value judgments. The only question is whose value judgments can be sustained by the facts.
All right. Let's look at the simple modern area in which modern evangelicals and modern fundamentalists have tried to prove the Schuller and Trout, for example. And they... Well, a lot of people see this. A lot of fundamentalists see this as something far older than any documents. That the shroud was the shroud in which God was in, that it can be tested. I'm sorry, you don't accept
Gentlemen.
The Schuller and Trout either.
I'm sorry.
Gentlemen.
I'm sorry.
Do you accept the Schuller and Trout or not?
Certainly not.
You don't? All right. I mean, I'm trying to find out what he is accepting.
Gentlemen, that's 20 minutes, but our timetable does allow us another five.
I think we'd rather switch to Christians. I'm sure people there want.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, the 20 minutes was allocated to that exchange, and that now brings us to a 20-minute break. So, if Mr. Henninger's there, can you indicate whether there's any refreshments and what?
Someone's got some wild fishes?
Across to my right, and then to the back, and then up to the stairs. And if that doesn't exhaust our question time, then I'll repeat the same procedure. Now, I'd invite one speaker, someone to challenge either speaker from this part of the room. If there's someone who has a question, this gentleman here. Thank you.
Question to Dr. Montgomery?
The question is to Dr. Montgomery.
Yes, Dr. Montgomery, your speech was extremely interesting, and the point you made about evidence was most interesting too. Evidence is, in fact, merely simply that which people will accept. There's no such thing as proving anything. Now, the fact is...
Excuse me, you're not sure you're here tonight? I say, are you not certain that you're here tonight?
I accept that evidence, do you? No, the thing is, the majority of Australian people are not here tonight, nor would they be likely to even if there was room, because the majority of people in Australia do not accept the evidence that the Christians claim is the justification to being exempt from rates and taxes. They believe all that the Christians are interested in is money. Now, this magnificent, expensive hall, you might say, one wonders, could it have been built at all if the Christian church was not exempt from rates and taxes? Now, the question I want to ask you is, do you think that the Christian message would be put over more effectively if it wasn't gaining so much money from the special privilege that it currently enjoys?
All right, that's the question. Okay.
I make it a policy not to come into a foreign country and instruct people on how they ought to organize their political system or assess their taxes. But I would like to make one point that I think arises out of this, and it's a point that was made previously by Malcolm Muggeridge in talking about humanism, atheism on the one hand, and historic Christianity on the other. Said Malcolm Muggeridge, I have yet to see a humanist leper colony. I have yet to see a humanist leper colony. What he meant by this is that you may want to complain about the fact that churches have special tax privileges, but maybe you ought to look at what churches have done with the money that they have. The fact of the matter is that there is no humanist St. Teresa. There are no humanist leper colonies. Humanists have not done a fraction for humanity that the churches have done, and that's perhaps a justification for money that they collect. We could go into the use of funds for eleemosynary activities tonight, but I'm still attempting vainly to get this thing on the track, and the track is the truth of it, not how it uses money.
All right, a question here to Mr. Plummer, this gentleman here.
Could you define very briefly what you understand a Christian is, please?
Right, someone who basically believes in Jesus Christ, believes that he was born, resurrected, and follows his teachings. I would accept that as a wide enough title for Christian. There's a variety of Christians, there's numerous Christian groups of different people interpreting it, but I would say that anyone who claims it, I mean, I'd use a self-definition. If the person says, I'm a Christian, and they adhere to the basic tenets, I'd say they're a Christian.
All right, that's the question. Now, is there a question to Dr. Montgomery from... I'll just take it from this immediate group that's seated. This gentleman here. It has to be a counter question.
Dr. Montgomery, you didn't answer Mark Plummer's point about the contradiction in an all-powerful, an all-knowing, and an all-loving God, that he can't be either of those, can't be all of those three together. Could you answer that one?
Well, actually, Mr. Plummer answered his own question, and he stuck it in passing very quickly because he didn't want to place much emphasis on it. It has to do with the nature of free will. The fact... I beg pardon? How can it be disappointing when I haven't finished it? This is not the bush. Let's try to be courteous.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, where was I? Yeah.
Anyone else want to try, Dr. Montgomery?
the matter of free will. Mr. Plummer noted that attempts have been made to deal with the problem of evil, as he stated it, by the argument from free will, and I'll state this argument very briefly, but I'd refer all of you to two very valuable publications on the subject. One is popular, the other is a highly technical philosophical work. The popular work is C.S. Lewis' The Problem of Pain, and the technical work is Alvin Plantinga's God and Other Minds, published by Cornell University Press. The line in these works goes something as follows. If you try to discover in the Bible the character of the God of the Bible, it turns out that the God of the Bible is a God who wants fellowship and love with his creatures. He wants a relationship. But relationships don't take place in the absence of freedom of choice. You cannot, for example, compel love. Love is something that is freely chosen on the basis of options. And therefore, when one says the evil in the world should have been eliminated by God, he shouldn't have permitted people to make the wrong choices that created problems and the like, this is tantamount to saying that God ought not to have sought relationships or to have entered into them. The God of the Bible is not a puppeteer. I believe the word puppeteer came up in this. The God of the Bible is not a puppeteer who looks down from the parapets of heaven and says to man, "Do you love me?" and then pulls the strings so that he looks up and says, "Yes, I love you." It doesn't operate that way. And as far as the question of animals who suffer even though they don't have free will, it's in the nature of the moral rejection of God that a monkey wrench is thrown into things, and evil is irrational. And therefore, when such choices are made, this kind of thing spills over into the natural world, and there are those who suffer who did not themselves enter into that original relationship. That is true of animals. It's also true in the case of natural catastrophes and the like. Now, whether you want to believe that that kind of an explanation is sound or not is one thing, but logically, that is compatible with the existence of the Christian God. That's the point that Plantinga makes, that philosophically, you cannot argue that there is a logical incompatibility between the existence of the Christian God and the condition that the world is in. And in order for Mr. Plummer to make his point, he's got to be able to show that there is logical incompatibility between these two considerations.
Thank you. Is there'll be opportunity in the summing up to cover any of the points the speakers might wish to do so. There's a question over here to Dr. Plummer, to Mr. Plummer.
Oh, Mr. Plummer, give me.
Yes, to the, no, the gentleman with the bandage hand.
This is to Mr. Plummer. I heard recently of someone who supposedly went to the Minister of Transport and said, "Why have you allowed all the accidents to happen?" He said, "I don't stand to take the blame for that. We make rules, and people disobeying the rules bring these accidents to happen." Now, I've heard much criticism of God because of the accidents that happen. How could a loving God allow that? I haven't heard you yet disprove the existence of God, nor disprove who Jesus Christ is. I feel like I've gone on a duck hunt, and you've got a great many wild ducks to shoot at. There's Shuler, and there's Falwell, and there's economics, and there's lots of things, but you could blow up the whole nest with one shot if you could disprove to me the existence of God through even scientific approaches, as have second law of thermodynamics or whatever, or if you could disprove to me Jesus Christ as to who he is. Could you do that?
Okay. Well, taking a step at a time, first, that accidents happen, that there's suffering, that there's evil. This is part of the argument that God is not all-loving. And that is that a knowing God, a supposedly all-knowing God, allows his accidents to happen, knows they will occur, knows there will be evil and suffering. If you take God to be an all-powerful, omnipresent being, then if he is all-powerful, he can't be all-good, because he allows these things to occur. If, on the other hand, he doesn't allow them to occur,
that he has no control over it, that he isn't all-powerful. So that's the concept of the God. Now, with the disproof of the God, Hare Krishna said to me the other week, how can you prove Krishna didn't exist? It's not up to me to prove whether Krishna existed or not. It's not up to me to prove that Allah existed or not. And I quite accept that there are mythical people, they're actual people who legends have been woven around. I'm even prepared to go as far as saying there may have been someone named Christ, but I'm up to the people who are putting forward that Christ existed and that Christ had these powers, that Christ is the Son of God, to prove it. They're putting forward the proposition. Let's look another way. People claim that down the southern highlands there's yetis. And a chap from the big country rang me during the week and said, how can you prove there's no yetis down there? And I said, well, short of slicing the whole of the countryside, putting down all the trees, setting out search parties to check they're not hiding anywhere, I can't disprove there's no yetis down there. But it's up to the people who say that there are yetis or yowies to prove it, to bring forward a carcass, to bring forward a good film of it, to bring forward photographs. So if you're putting up the propositions that firstly, Christ exists, and that secondly, Christ is the Son of God, and thirdly, that he had those powers, then I say, well, you prove it to me. And rather than me disprove it, I can use philosophical proofs to suggest to you about the all-loving, all-knowing God. I can suggest to you that a lot of people believe in Christ because they're brought up to it culturally. I can suggest to you that people believe in Christ because the Bible says so. And then you've got this great circular argument that can be used by virtually any people with a sacred text. So I don't see it as my job to disprove. I can put suggestions forward, but I say, you prove it. To date, what you put forward hasn't convinced me.
Standard for Christian morality.
I'll give you.
The question was, Dr. Montgomery, can you establish for me the absolute standards of Christian morality? That was the question.
What are they based on?
What are they based on? They're based upon God's own declarations as to what we ought to be up to and what we ought not to be up to. In other words, if it's possible to establish the revelatory character of the scriptures and or the deity of Jesus Christ, then what we find presented in the scriptures and or in the teachings of Jesus Christ turn out to have this character. And the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead is the principal testing stone for the legitimacy of his claims. I agree with Mr. Plummer that the burden of proof in reference to God's existence does not rest upon him. The burden of proof rests upon those who assert that. But the unfortunate thing is that there is a responsibility that Mr. Plummer has, and I don't think he's discharged it. And that's the responsibility of backing up his criticisms. That's the difficulty. Mr. Plummer makes all sorts of irresponsible judgments, such as that Christians are people who psychologically find themselves in that position, and I keep asking him again and again if the evidence historically relative to Jesus Christ isn't the sort of thing that he needs to face. And every time I bring this up, off we go into financial accountability.
All right. Is there someone from this part standing up that would like to ask a question? Yes, I think I explained the procedure. I'd be trying to be fair. Yes, and as I also pointed out, that there wouldn't be opportunity for everybody to be able to ask a question. And I saw someone else's. I'm only human. There was someone back there that wanted to ask a question. Gentleman with a beard who... Did you want to ask a question? This is an opportunity to ask a question to Mr. Plummer. Is there anyone in that back section standing that would like to address? All right, there's a question which is close enough there.
Oh, I can't hear, sorry, you have to speak up.
Is that better?
Yep. speak right into it.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Mr. Plummer and Mr. Montgomery, but mostly Mr. Plummer, it seems tonight we're meeting here because we think that life has meaning. You say it, and Mr. Montgomery says it too.
Christians say that life has meaning because of Christ, and that history is heading somewhere, and our lives have purpose in Christ. It would seem to me that society we're living in here in Australia, and also in America, is a society that's lost its direction. Hence, the way people's lives are going, where they're putting their values in material goods, etc. The increase in family breakups, all statistics you want to quote, they'll back it up. Let me ask you, if we are just animals, and if we're a product of chance, and if we're atoms that are bouncing around together, what purpose does your life has? What meaning does it have? And why don't you kill yourself right now? Because in the end, it won't really matter.
Well, there's quite a few propositions up there. One is that society... A lot of early Christians kill themselves because they believe, of course, that heaven was worth going to. Therefore, one should kill yourself immediately. And, of course, a lot of people have actually done that. They believe that because there is a heaven, they should suicide.
Name one Christian who killed himself because he wanted to get to heaven.
Dr. Montgomery, you'll have an opportunity in your summing up to address this.
Well, I'll name 1,268 in Guyana. Who believe that by killing themselves, they'd rid themselves of this terrible world and go to heaven. Now, do I believe life has meaning? Yeah, I believe life's got a lot of meaning. Just to come up to Sydney is a beautiful place, and I've enjoyed this. Now, if I kill myself tomorrow or tonight, then I wouldn't get to see other beautiful places. I wouldn't get to do other interesting things. Because I believe I've got one life and I've got to pack a lot into it. And therefore, I do want to pack a lot into it. And on my tombstone, they can put Mark Plummer, eat, drank, and was merry. Now, as for where life's going, and society losing direction, the fact is, of course, that people just don't consider where they're going. I'd agree with you with that. People basically just tend to drift along. People don't take stock of things. People don't take stock of where they're going, and it needs far more debate. For the people who've got here tonight, think of how many who haven't come to discuss this. Number of people who don't even think about these sort of topics. So at least, perhaps we're all united, at least we're keen enough to come along tonight to have a think about this particular area, and you're a great audience. Now, what meaning does my life have? My life has meaning because I enjoy life, because I've enjoyed what's happened to date, because there's a lot of things I've yet to do, and there's a lot of things I still want to do, and therefore I have no desire to kill myself. I have a lot more I want to achieve, and I'll be feeling a lot more into this life. I certainly won't be killing myself.
Thank you. Yes. There's a hand right at the back. If you can just wait for a moment, the microphone will be there.
I'd like to address this question to Mr. Plummer.
No, it's Dr. Montgomery.
Dr. Montgomery. Can get Mr. Plummer up.
Have a go at me later.
All right, you can say yours. No, is that question to Dr. Montgomery? Yes, there's one here. Excuse me.
Well,
just here.
Yes, Dr. Montgomery, I'd just like you to comment on the point that was made about the church changing its attitude over the years. I don't think we can deny that in the history of Christianity, church position has changed on issues as time goes on, and that science has contributed to that. We all know that Galileo was virtually exiled over believing that the sun was at the center of the solar system. Can you comment on that and comment on what that means about the strength of Christian values now?
I'm not here to defend the historic church. There is no doubt about the fact that in any system you have a wide variety of followers and a wide variety of groups that come into existence related to the original message. The expression fellow travelers has come in Marxist circles to describe those people who have perhaps not expressed as they should the beliefs that are at the heart of the system. Sure, you can find variations in the teachings of the Christian churches. You can find change in the attitudes of Christian churches toward social problems and other matters. But the thing that fascinates me is that with all of the denominations and church bodies through the centuries, you have at the heart a single message. The single message is summed up in the ecumenical creeds of the Church, the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, the Athanasian Creed, which state that man's condition is such that he desperately needs help. He is not capable of saving himself or his society by pulling himself up by his own bootstraps. His life is not half as enjoyable as he thinks it is, and the dark night of the soul comes to every person. But Jesus Christ came to earth to die for us and make it possible for us to have a new and different kind of relationship with God. That's at the heart of Eastern Orthodoxy, Roman Catholicism, and Protestantism. And to my way of thinking, we are not fair to the Christian Church when we pick out this fact or that fact and emphasize this change or that change. One other small point about this, my doctoral dissertation at the University of Strasbourg dealt with the influence of the Reformation on the rise of science in the 17th century. And I discovered, to my amazement, that the reformers were at the heart of motivating the scientists of the day in the direction of the investigations to which they engaged. Luther, for example, supported the Copernican system, therefore, there is a great deal of superficiality in the standardized criticisms of the Church as always dragging its feet, always attempting to crush progress. A lot of this comes from a work by Andrew Dixon White, The History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom, which is bad history, and unfortunately it's the basis of a good deal of the allegations that are most frequently presented along those lines.
Thank you. Yes, I'll take your question now to Mr. Plummer. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Mr. Plummer, the Bible clearly states in Hebrews, and don't hold that right, that Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Quite recently, I was in the country of the Philippines about 6 or 7 weeks before the elections, and I clearly saw a young 20-year-old Filipino boy crippled from birth walk. I clearly saw 5 or 6 people with blind eyes opened up. I heard deaf ears opened up. I saw a tumor, a goiter on a lady's neck clearly disappear. Like, it was there before, but suddenly it wasn't there. Like, I'm not, it's just that I saw it. Actually, it was an experience that I saw the power of God working. And a great American evangelist, incidentally, by the name of T.L. Osborne, said, if Jesus is the same today as he was yesterday, let him do what he did yesterday today. I'd like to get your opinion on miracles and whether the fact is that you can't believe or whether you won't believe.
Now, you mentioned the Philippines, and for many years there was a great deal of claims of psychic surgeons, that people were using powers given to them by God to remove goiters, to open up bodies. As you know, I'm involved with the skeptics, and we looked at this very closely. We took films of those. We found the techniques were being used, techniques such as magician's palming, techniques about pinning to open up the body. We took films of that. Now, Australians were going over to the Philippines for operations. I've written 5 articles on psychic surgery, on faith healing, of that dramatic nature. And we have performed in Sydney, and it was on our last convention of the skeptics, and we have performed it in Melbourne. We've performed psychic surgery. We've performed the same techniques. Now, for those psychic surgeons from the Philippines that have come to Australia, we've offered them $20,000 to do it under controlled conditions. Now, the first control is check that the person has the condition. That is, that they are medically examined beforehand. Because one of the greatest tricks is to bring in someone in a wheelchair and have them get up and walk, or to bring in someone who says they've got a pain in the stomach and produce a tumour out of it. Now, if there is this sort of faith healing, then why are these people operating in backyard sheds? Why aren't we bringing them into the hospitals in the Philippines and into the hospitals in Australia? Now, the last psychic surgeon that came to Australia, we followed him around, and we were able to show the techniques he was using. That was over a year ago. We have our own magicians have been able to show psychic surgery, and we have a standing offer that we will demonstrate psychic surgery to any group that we will appear to produce goiters, tumours, that we're prepared to bring out great forward amounts of blood out of people's body, what appears to be a miracle. But under scientifically controlled conditions, We've not yet found one. Now, all those psychic surgeons that have come to Australia, and they've been to every capital city and many country areas, we've thrown out this challenge to each and every one of them and to the people who brought them out. And we have actually a kit, which is available for $2, in which we set out step by step how psychic surgery is done. It's a 60-page kit. You can read through it and you'll know exactly how psychic surgery is done. You'll see the testimony of doctors from America who went out to examine it, and you can read how it's been replicated. So here we have, you've mentioned a specific miracle.